Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the January-February edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. This first article, out of the prologue section, is written by Glenn Fleischman, and it is titled, Let It Snow. This year, a blizzard of creative works lose their copyrights, including a beloved Robert Frost poem. Whose woods these are? Whoa. We can't quote any more of Robert Frost stopping by woods on a snowy evening because it is still under copyright as this magazine goes to press. But come January 1st, 2019, we, you, and everyone in America will be able to quote it at length on any platform. At midnight on New Year's Eve, all works first published in the United States in 1923 will enter the public domain. It has been 21 years since the last mass expiration of copyright in the U.S. That deluge of works includes not just Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, which appeared first in the New Republic in 1923, but hundreds of thousands of books, musical compositions, paintings, poems, photographs, and films. After January 1st, any record label can issue a dubstep version of the 1923 hit, Yes, We Have No Bananas. Any middle school can produce Theodore Pratt's stage adaptation of The Picture of Dorian Gray, and any historian can publish Winston Churchill's The World Crisis with her own extensive annotations. Any artist can create and sell a feminist response to Marcel Duchamp's seminal Dadaist piece, The Large Glass, the bride striped bare by her bachelors, even. And any filmmaker can remake Cecil B. DeMille's original The Ten Commandments and post it on YouTube. The public domain has been frozen in time for 20 years, and we're reaching the 20-year thaw, says Jennifer Jenkins, director of Duke Law School's Center for the Study of Public Domain. The release is unprecedented, and its impact on culture and creativity could be huge. We have never seen such a mass entry into the public domain in the digital age. The last one, in 1998, when 1922 slipped its copyright bond, predated Google. We have shortchanged a generation, says Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. The 20th century is largely missing from the Internet. For academics fearful of quoting from copyrighted text, teachers who may be violating the law with every photocopy, and modern-day artists in search of inspiration, the event is a cause for celebration. For those who dread seeing Frost's immortal ode to winter used in an ad for snow tires, Public Domain Day, as it is sometimes known, will be less joyful. Despite that, even fierce advocates for copyright agree that, after 95 years, it is time to release these works. There comes a point when a creative work belongs to history as much as to its authors and her heirs, said Mary Rasenberger, executive director of the Authors Guild. We can blame Mickey Mouse for the long wait. In 1998, Disney was one of the longest in the choir of corporate voices advocating for longer copyright protections. At the time, all works published before January 1, 1978 were entitled to copyright protection for 75 years. All authors' works created before or after that date were under copyright for the lifetime of the creator, plus 50 years. Steamboat Willie, featuring Mickey Mouse's first appearance on screen in 1928, was set to enter the public domain in 2004. At the urging of Disney and others, Congress passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, named for the late singer, songwriter, and California representative, adding 20 years to the copyright term. Mickey would be protected until 2024, and no copyrighted work would enter the public domain again until 2019, creating a bizarre 20-year hiatus between the release of works from 1922 and those from 1923. This hole in history was accidental, but it occurred at a remarkable moment. The novelist Willa Cather called 1922 the year the world broke into two, the start of a great literary, artistic, and cultural upheaval. In 1922, Ulysses by James Joyce and T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland were published, and the Harlem Renaissance blossomed with the arrival of Claude McKay's poetry in Harlem Shadows. For two decades, those works have been in the public domain, enabling artists, critics, and others to burnish that notable year to a high gloss in our historical memory. In comparison, 1923 can feel dull. But that was the year Noel Coward staged his first musical, the hit London Calling. And Gene Toomer came out with his breakthrough novel about African-American life, Cain. Because access to these and other works from the year has been limited, our understanding of the tumultuous 1920s is skewed. That will begin to change January 1st, when digital compendia such as the Internet Archive, Google Books, and HathiTrust will make tens of thousands of books available, with more to follow. They and others will also add heaps of newspapers, magazines, movies, and other materials. Much of the same will happen every January 1st until 2073, revealing long overlooked works from the Harlem Renaissance, the Great Depression, World War II, and beyond. After 2073, works published by the authors who died 7 decades earlier will expire each year. We're going to open these time capsules on a yearly basis and potentially have our understanding of that year and all the contents change, said Paul St. Amour, a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania and editor of Modernism and Copyright. We can't predict what uses people are going to make of the work we make available, said Mike Furlow, executive director at HathiTrust. And that's what makes that so exciting. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. How refreshing it is to quote freely from another iconic Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken, published in his poetry collection, Mountain Interval, in 1916. Its copyright expired in 1992, and that has made all the difference. The poem has inspired lyrics from Bruce Hornsby, Melissa Etheridge, and George Strait, and its phrases have been used to sell cars, careers, computers, and countless dorm room posters that feature the final lines as an exhortation to individualism that the poet likely never intended. On January 1st, HathiTrust will publish Frost's collection, New Hampshire, including Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening outline, and it will be finally available for anyone to adapt. Perhaps no one is more bemused by that prospect than the composer Eric Whitaker. In 1999, believing the poem had already entered the public domain, the last mini copyright extension prevented that, Whitaker accepted a commission to turn it into a choral piece. After just 2 performances, Whitaker said Frost's publisher and the Frost estate shut him down, refusing to license the work. Whitaker eventually produced a different version of the work titled Sleep, with lyrics written for it by the poet Charles Anthony Silvestri. He is now considering releasing the work in its original form. All I wanted to do, Whitaker said, is illuminate the original poem with music. In a tiny sidebar article here, 1923 Skidoo. When that year's copyright skedaddles, you'll have instant access to countless titles, including these overlooked gems. The Vanishing American in Ladies' Home Journal by Zane Grey, one of the first literary critiques of the treatment of Native Americans, harsher than the later novel in silent film. The Handbook of Cookery for a Small House by Jesse Conrad, a peek into the life of author Jesse Conrad via his wife's recipe collection. Our American Advantage by author Conan Doyle. The creator of Sherlock Holmes recounts his popular and controversial lecture tour in support of modern spiritualism. The Chip Woman's Fortune by Willis Richardson. The first drama by an African American author produced on Broadway. A one-act story of a family in financial straits. Nebraska, In the Nation, by Willa Cather. She laments the cultural and economic homogenization in her beloved state. And finally, The Real Story of a Bootlegger, by Anonymous. The purportedly honest account of life as a criminal under the 18th Amendment. Prohibition made me a millionaire. And this next article, also out of the prologue section, is written by Franz Linz, and it is titled, Great Ball of Fire. Decades after a flaming meteorite plunged to Earth, scientists still mine its fragments for clues to the cosmos. Most likely, it came from the asteroid belt, that cosmic junk heap between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter that harbors rubble left over from the sun's formation. Plowing into Earth's atmosphere during the early morning hours of February 8, 1969, the meteor, a stardust memory about the size of a Buick, produced an incandescent blue-white vapor that streaked the sky as a shooting star. The Great Ball of Fire blazed briefly over the Sierra Madre of Mexico before charging over the Chihuahuan Desert and splintering near the village of Pueblito de Alandre, due south of El Paso, Texas. When a meteor smacks down, it becomes a meteorite, and this one scattered more than 2 tons of fragments like birdseed over nearly 100 square miles. With the help of local schoolchildren who asked for bottles of soda for their efforts, Smithsonian researchers recovered hundreds of specimens, a selection of which are on display at the National Museum of Natural History. Studded with molten clumps of minerals distributed like currants in a fruitcake, the Allende meteorite, as it became known, contains the oldest material in the Smithsonian Institution, or any institution. The ratio of lead and potassium-argon isotopes in this block of mineral components, including olivine, pyroxene, feldspar, and glass, gives it an age of roughly 4.57 billion years, which makes it older than Earth itself. Indeed, it's the oldest object at our disposal in the solar system. Our planet is continually bombarded by rocks and extraterrestrial dust. An estimated 25 million meteors enter the atmosphere each day. Of the small percentage to survive the fiery ordeal and pierce Earth's surface, most fall into the sea. The Allende meteorite wasn't the most devastating space rock to make land. That honor probably belongs to the asteroid suspected of wiping out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. Or the biggest single chunk, that may be Hoba, the 66-tonner that arrived 80,000 years ago in what is now Namibia. Or even the biggest of modern times, a supersized one dubbed Tunguska, ruptured over Russia in 1908 and incinerated 800 square miles of forest. But it's surely the most scientifically significant. A rich fund of information about the evolution of the gas and dust cloud, the solar nebula that coalesced into the sun and planets. Having fallen on the eve of the Apollo 11 moon landing, the Allende meteorite may also be the world's most comprehensively studied rock. For nearly a decade, planetary scientists had been prepping for the arrival of lunar samples, perfecting their analytical technology with new instruments designed to measure everything from radioactivity decay to elemental composition. Today, even as Smithsonian scientists conduct ongoing analysis of the meteorite, they are also the source of Allende investigations on an international scale. They lend microslides of the meteorite to researchers worldwide. We love being able to loan out the materials so folks can do their own research, and these rocks can tell us their stories, says Kari Corrigan, curator of the meteorite collection. The Allende meteorite is a book from outer space filled with primordial minerals and all sorts of stories and secrets, says Chi Ma, director of the analytical facility at Caltech's Geological and Planetary Sciences Division. Ma is both a meteorist, the designation meteorologist was claimed first by weather forecasters, and a nano-mineralogist, a term he coined for a scientist who peers into a rock's tiniest recesses for even tinier particles of minerals and the tiny features within them. Ma has spent much of the last 11 years probing the Allende meteorite. In his laboratory, he scans an Allende shard with an electron microscope and talks nanomineralogy. When you examine a meteorite down to micrometers and nanoscales, you discover clues to what was happening when the rock was formed or when the sample was altered. While 5,390 minerals have been identified on Earth to date, only about 65 are thought of to have been charter members of the solar nebula, the kind of minerals found in meteorites. The earliest minerals were formed by condensation from solar gases at high temperatures, Ma says. These refractory minerals were the first solid materials in our solar system. When Ma started studying Allende in January 2007, he adds, only about 30 refractory minerals were known. He's found another 30 or so. So far, Ma has discovered 19 new minerals embedded in the Allende meteorite. He named his favorite, Pangiat, after Pan Gu, a giant from Chinese mythology who separated yin from yang to create the earth and the heavens. Half a century after the meteorite made contact with our world, its impact continues to deepen. And let's move on to book club. The Rest of the USA. In How to Hide an Empire, Daniel Immerwahr explores America far beyond the borders of the lower 48. Interviewed by Anna Diamond. Why do you consider the United States an empire? From day one, the United States has included both states and territories, with the territories treated differently. In 1940, when the Philippines was a U.S. possession, there were 19 million U.S. nationals living outside of the 48 states. That's more than immigrant or African-American populations at the time. Empire can be a loaded term. It can be used as a pejorative, but I'm not talking about the country's character. I'm talking about its shape, its territories and outposts. Today, around 4 million people live in the U.S. overseas territories. That's about the populations of Maine, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island combined. Technology helped the United States give up territories? Traditionally, countries claimed colonies to secure resources or military outposts. By the 1940s, the United States has satisfied some of those needs with technology. Developing synthetic rubber meant it didn't need tropical colonies to grow rubber. With aircraft and wireless communications, it didn't require continuous swaths of land for railroad tracks or telegraph cables to maintain its military presence. And last question, how do we think about our territories today? A lot of people don't. Woodrow Wilson spoke of them as lying outside the charmed circle of our own national life. That attitude is ingrained. The territories almost never appear on maps of the country, and census statistics usually exclude them. If it had been included, Manila would have been one of the top 10 largest cities in the country in the 1940s. You can see that neglect today in how little aid Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands got after Hurricanes Maria and Irma, or by the lack of national attention to Typhoon Yuri, which laid waste to the Northern Marianas. And a little FYI by April White. 20 years after the first emojis appeared, the illustrated language has taken over the world. About 4,000 years ago, someone scrawled a smiling face on a clay pitcher. When it was unearthed in Turkey in 2017, one archaeologist called it the oldest smiley emoji, reminding us that silly cartoon symbols were around long before their first pixelated appearance on a cell phone screen 20 years ago. Today, 90% of people online speak emoji with curious local dialects. The most popular emoji. The Emoji Tracker website reports Twitter users have sent the symbol of the laughing emoji over 2 billion times worldwide since 2013. And the least popular is the aerial tramway. It's been more useful in Japan, where it was created, than elsewhere. And lost in translation, could emojis become our universal language? Probably not. Studies show that men and women use this limited 2,823 symbol vocabulary differently, as do people of different ages and cultures. And for the remainder of today's program, I'm going to introduce you to the special issue about the 17-year War on Terror. On the introduction page, there's a photograph of dog tags hanging, and the caption reads, "Nearly 7,000 uninscribed dog tags hang at the Old North Church in Boston. It's the first public memorial honoring service members lost in the global war on terrorism." So in this special issue, there's several stories I'll be reading to you out of this edition of the Smithsonian for the remaining Sundays in January and February. America at War. The Nation's Epic Expanding Fight Against Terrorism Overseas. In the matter of war, the American language creates its own fog. We speak not only of wars, but also of armed conflicts, military engagements, combat operations, expeditions, policing actions, raids, airstrikes, and shows of force. And even with so many labels, we use the term war pretty loosely. Does the Honey War really count? The 1836 Missouri-Iowa border dispute, named for the chief on the ground casualty, Three Beehives, and was settled at the Supreme Court? The Roostook War? It was another 19th century border dispute in Maine, which the United States and England settled bloodlessly. The global war on terrorism, declared in 2001, surely counts. But it has barreled onward through a fog of its own. A series of vagaries concerning territory, scale, foes, and metrics for success. exactly when the war in Afghanistan surpassed the Vietnam War as America's longest overseas war is debated. The comparison depends on which benchmarks you use. Last September, however, the United States reached an indicator that clears away at least some of the confusion. The first cohort of Americans who were born after the terrorist attack of September 11, 2001, became old enough to enlist in the war that followed. Whatever else it is, the global war on terrorism is now a second-generation war. With that in mind, this double issue, as I mentioned, of Smithsonian brings into focus who is fighting this war and why, and where, and even what they've left behind. These men and women make up a tiny fraction of the U.S. population, and 17 years is a long time. But our awareness of this conflict shouldn't become so normal that, to borrow one general's valediction, it fades away. First, let's look at a nation at arms. By one count, the United States has been at war at some time in 93.5% of the calendar years between 1775 and 2018. Of course, this depends on how you define war. We define it as using military force or the imminent threat of force, as in the gunboat diplomacy of the 1850s, to achieve national ends. There's an infographic here that basically totals years with conflict as 228 and years without conflict as 16, starting with the Revolutionary War in 1775 through 1783. Never sheath your sword until you have obtained full and ample justice, General Washington proclaimed. And the War of 1812 next. America's first declared war ended in a deadlock and with no gain or loss in territory. The Civil War of 1861 to 65. A total of 3.1 million soldiers fought and at least 620,000 died in the nation's bloodiest conflict. The Suez Wars in 1851 to 91. By the end, the Census Bureau was proclaiming the closing of the American frontier. And with 1917 through 1918, World War I, President Wilson's armed neutrality held until Germany began sinking American ships. The Great Depression, 1929 through 1939, amid an enduring global calamity, the U.S. had its longest period of relative peace. World War II came along in 1941 through 1945, where some 407,000 U.S. service members died in the largest armed conflict in human history. Then the Vietnam War, 1964 to 1975. Congress authorized President Johnson to escalate U.S. involvement, but never declared war. And finally, from this graphic, is the War on Terrorism, 2001 to present. President George W. Bush vowed to bring our enemies to justice, or justice to our enemies. And now we move on to Where We Fight, by Stephanie Saville. This new map shows for the first time that the United States is now combating terrorism in 40% of the world's nations. Less than a month after the September 11th terrorist attack on the United States, U.S. troops, with support from British, Canadian, French, German, and Australian forces, invaded Afghanistan to fight al-Qaeda and the Taliban. More than 17 years later, the global war on terrorism initiated by President George W. Bush is truly global, with Americans actively engaged in counterterrorism in 80 nations on 6 continents. This map is the most comprehensive depiction in civilian circles of the U.S. military and government anti-terrorist actions overseas in the past 2 years. To develop it, my colleagues and I at Brown University's Cost of War Project at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, along with Smithsonian Magazine, combed through U.S. and foreign government sources, published and unpublished reports, military websites, and geographical databases. We contacted foreign embassies in the U.S. and the military's United States African Command, and we conducted interviews with journalists, academics, and others. We found that, contrary to what most Americans believe, the war on terror is not winding down. It has spread to more than 40% of the world's countries. The war isn't being waged by the military alone, which has spent $1.9 trillion fighting terrorism since 2009. The State Department has spent $127 billion in the last 17 years to train police, military, and border patrol agents in many countries, and to develop anti-terrorism education programs, among other activities. Because we have been conservative in our selections, U.S. efforts to combat terrorism abroad are likely more extensive than the map shows. Even so, the vast reach evident here may prompt Americans to ask whether the war on terror has met its goals and whether they are worth the human and financial cost. So to summarize the map, 80 total affected countries are engaged through 40 U.S. military bases, 65 counterterrorism training, 26 U.S. military exercises, 14 U.S. troops in combat, and 7 air and drone strikes. And now, military intelligence. In a new Smithsonian poll, troops and veterans take aim at conventional wisdom. It's no secret that many Americans are fatigued by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, it's clear for the first time that the troops are, too, according to a new poll conducted by Smithsonian with two partners, the Defense Department publication Stars and Stripes and the Schar School at George Mason University. 17 years after the U.S. led military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, more than 80% of 1,031 service members and veterans surveyed agreed with the statement that the occupations have been going on too long. As far as we know, this survey was the first one to pose that question to current and former service members. Their frustration is significant because they also voiced strong support for the war on terror generally, with 83% saying it should continue. On the home front, 65% of respondents backed the move by President Trump to deploy armed forces at the U.S. border with Mexico to prevent illegal immigration. At the same time, the great majority appear to take a dim view of the administration's proposal to deport non-citizen service members or their families. The military community was more in step with the administration's proposed policy, currently being challenged in court, to ban transgender people in the armed services. Overall, only 39% of respondents said transgender people should be allowed to serve. In particular, though, female and millennium respondents were more in favor of transgender troops than the survey population as a whole, with more than 50% expressing support. Taken together, the findings suggest that military life poses special difficulties for women, despite their eagerness to serve. About 2/3 of current and former female service members said they had experienced sexual discrimination while in the military. The same proportion said they had experienced sexual harassment or assault. That level of mistreatment is twice as high as other recent studies have reported. Perhaps women subjected to such duress were more likely than other women to respond to survey invitation. As for males, only 6% reported experiencing sexual discrimination, harassment, or assault. Some answers depended on the age of the survey taker. Compared with millennials, the greatest generation was twice as supportive of sending troops to the border, half as supportive of transgender troops, far more likely to say the military prepared them for later life, and about 1/7 as likely to relax by playing first-person shooter video games. In the poll conducted over the 2018 Veterans Day holiday, more than 23,000 digital subscribers to Stars and Stripes news services worldwide received an email invitation to participate anonymously in an online opinion survey about military policy and conditions in the armed forces. The respondents were 109 active duty service members and 922 veterans from all branches of the armed services, including officers as well as enlisted personnel. Among them were 76 women. The analysis excluded 676 other respondents who were not current or former service members. A research team led by Delton Daigle, a political scientist at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, designed the poll and performed the statistical analysis of results. Overall, the margin of error was ±3%, but the figure was higher for smaller subsamples. For results limited to female respondents, the margin of error was about 11%. And I'll end with one of the final questions asked on the survey. Which of the following do you feel is the greatest external threat to American security? 18% said rogue nations, 38% said terrorist organizations, 36% said rival powers, and 8% criminal organizations. Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January-February edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long, until next time.